This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 28th of October 2012 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Weekly is in association with Tourism Australia. Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly, episode 173, with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on today's show, we'll speak to British TV reporter Matt Fry about what it's like to cover the US elections and his upcoming documentary about President Obama.
We'll also sit down with author Patrick Kingsley and ask him why we're all so desperate to be Danish.
It has a different culture. It's not a simple life there, but I think it's a leaner life. The design is sort of cleaner, simpler.
And we'll get all of our word bubbles in order and find out why comic strips are a perfect way to explain everything from the Cuban Revolution to Freud.
No, I don't understand that either. All that plus we'll get next week's big stories right now, and we'll play you a couple of our favourite tracks right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Hello there, Andrew.
How are you? How are you feeling, Steve?
I'm feeling pretty good, actually. It's been quite a busy week, but I think, touch wood, we've finished the issue.
Yes, we finished. I think we've got kind of like, I think I can say this, kind of sore loins. We've given birth to a big one, haven't we? a giant baby is heading forth into the world. Is that all right?
That's, yeah, okay, fine. Well, we're stuck with it now. Yes, the December-January issue of Monocle has been pushed kicking and screaming out of the door of Midori House and on the way to the printers, soon to be on a newsstand near you. And it's rather big, isn't it?
It's a giant. And it's just, I think what's great for us is that we've seen the kind of that issue develop over the last few years. And that we always know it's a bit of a monster coming, but I think we kind of like it because it goes a little bit off-piste to the normal format. And there are so many bits and pieces in there that it's slightly crazy.
It is. But we got there in the end.
We didn't cry?
No. No,
I don't think
you came quite close though.
Yeah, well, I normally
on Friday you came very close. Yes. I thought the whole thing was going to fall apart.
Well, Steve, you did say a few personal things, but I'm not going to hold that against you.
I think it was reasonable. Anyway, so that's done, and we've got all sorts of other things to look forward to, like Alpino, the February issue, and also I'm off to New York in 2 days' time.
And for work.
Yes.
You're covering the US elections.
I am. We're going to have a series of Midori House specials, election specials. They've been working on some very exciting new introductions for Midori House as well. Have you heard them yet?
No.
They're really good.
Have you been secretly commissioning things behind people's backs?
I have. Yeah, yeah. We've got a special voice artist in to... It's Daniel Giacopelli, but he has voiced a special sort of introduction to Midori House.
Have you managed to weave the words Steve Bloomfield into the kind of intro a few times?
I think he does say, please welcome your host, Steve Bloomfield. Yeah.
God. You have no shame, man. You have no shame.
I didn't do it.
It is going to be exciting because I think that we've been covering the elections well, and we've got a really good team in the US, and obviously we have Sasha Isenberg, who's our DC correspondent, who's written one of the best books about the election process.
He really has.
And so do you know what your kind of guest lineup is, or are you kind of make it up on the day?
No, we've actually got a fairly good lineup already.
A fairly good lineup?
No, as in like...
Who are the ones that are not very good?
No, it's very good, actually. I'm quite excited by the whole thing. So that's Midori House, every day, 1800 hours at London time, 1300 hours East Coast this week. The week after... 1400 hours on the East Coast because the clocks change.
God, look at you. It was clock clever as well.
Yeah, there we are. Anyway, but that's one thing that's happening next week. Should we find out some other things that are happening next week?
Yes, because talking about making people cry, here's Tom Edwards.
Hi, team. Thanks for your warm welcome as always. I always love the Monocle Weekly, our Monocle Weekly chats.
Apparently they found you cowering in the toilets today and you had to be dragged in here.
Well, you know, I try and... You know, prepare myself psychologically, but to no avail so far.
We love
Go on.
You.
We love you. What's going to be happening? Well, look into your... So this is a bit where Andrew makes some joke about crystal balls, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Go on.
Here's Tom Edwards polishing his crystal ball.
Oh, right, what an introduction that was. Well, you're talking about the US elections. of course, today is just election fest internationally. I thought that's an interesting place to start.
Yeah,
we've got Ukrainian parliamentary elections.
I love those ones.
We've got Brazilian municipal elections, Lithuanian parliamentary elections, Finnish, Chilean municipal elections, Sicilian regional elections. The world has gone election crazy today. I'm more intrigued by the Klitschko, Vitaly Klitschko, in the Ukrainian battles. Fascinating. The heavyweight champion of the world, Andrew, I'm sure you're well aware of.
Andrew
knows this sport.
Can I just say, you can take that sneer off your face.
I'm not sneering.
I know what's coming here.
Do you know, I went to Kiev. I went to a party in Kiev, as you do, and he was there with his brother.
Vladimir?
Yeah, the other big lad.
Yeah, both big lads.
They were both there. There was the Ukrainian entry to Eurovision.
Wow.
There were three presidents, two of whom hated each other, one of whom had tried to put the other one in jail. But actually, it was such a small kind of country, in a sense, the elite is so small, that everyone was in the same room. And they thought, hell, we'll just go for it.
And who was playing piano? Wow.
And Elton John was playing piano.
What's this event? Sounds incredible.
I did write it up in Monocle. It was the opening of the Viktor Pinchuk Gallery, who's a kind of oligarch, yes. And I went to do a kind of fly on the wall piece.
Fantastic. Well, all eyes will be trained, you know, on Kiev and throughout the Ukraine as well. What a day.
You've got one more, haven't you?
Well, I like to change the pace, as you know, when we do these, when I gaze into my crystal ball.
Changing the pace from what to what?
From serious, hard-hitting news journalism, which we've just been enjoying.
Can I say, you were
to something a bit more frothy.
You trailed weeks before everyone got talking about it, about the man jumping out of the capsule 10 miles above the Earth.
I heard it here first.
I
was derided for mentioning that.
No, I loved that.
And it swept all before it, news-wise. On Wednesday, it's obviously Halloween. Anyone got any exciting Halloween plans?
Mm. I'm going to be in New York.
Of course.
Yeah. God,
are you not going out trick-or-treating, Andrew, as I would have expected?
No, I'm not.
Fair enough.
Not knocking on strangers' doors asking for chocolate.
Well, no, but you see, Steve, interestingly, chocolate leads me on. The event that I'm most intrigued by. It's the Salon du Chocolat in Paris on Wednesday. And the year's theme is the new worlds of chocolate. 12,600 square metres of space entirely dedicated to chocolate in all its forms.
That sounds like we could send Marcus Hippie to report on that.
Might never see him again, though.
Our menu editor.
He would certainly be intrigued by it. But that's taking place in
Paris. He'd only like it if it was filled with vodka as well, though.
Yes,
that's true.
The only chocolates he ever brings back from Finland are ones filled with vodka.
They're not pleasant.
They're really not, are they?
No.
On that wonderful gastronomic note, Tom Edwards, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're going to be crossing over to America right after this.
London, Toronto, Tokyo.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Londres, Toronto, Tokyo.
Essa é a Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London. Das ist Monocle 24.
Hong Kong,
Zurich,
London.
This was Monocle 24.
Hong Kong, Zurich, London.
Tu vai
Monocle
24.
From London,
in London,
London, cara.
De Londres.
This is Monocle 24.
Matt Fry is a seasoned Washington correspondent for British television and currently delivers his informed and detailed analysis for the UK's Channel 4 station. He's one of those voices you just want to listen to.
Today, Channel 4 is airing his latest documentary, The American Road Trip, Obama's Story, which sees Fry travelling through the Midwest to find out a simple fact. Can Obama get re-elected on the 6th of November? Earlier, me and Steve caught up with Fry to talk about the life of the correspondent and the election.
Matt Fry, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly. You're covering this election for Channel 4 News, and you've got a new film out this weekend, in fact later today, The American Road Trip, Obama's Story, which traces sort of how his 4 years, or almost 4 years in power, have not perhaps met the high expectations of his supporters. Is part of the problem that, as Mario Cuomo once said, politicians campaign in poetry, but they govern in prose?
That is indeed part of the problem, and I think it's particularly a problem for Obama because the poetry of his candidacy 4 years ago was so poetic. He was really a candidate the likes of which we hadn't seen for a very long time, and Americans, even quite a few Republicans, although they're probably loath to admit it these days, projected their hopes and dreams onto this very unique candidate. But the problem, in a sense, for Obama has been that voting for him once is a little bit like losing your virginity. It's historic, perhaps slightly disappointing afterwards, and you never ever have to do it again. And in a sense, the prose of the last 4 years has been very prosaic, because he inherited such a difficult situation, especially with the economy, but also because the Republicans have been helpful ever, trying to oppose every single thing that he's tried to do. So partly he has himself to blame because he helped to raise expectations that he could then not meet, and partly he can blame the other side for blocking him all the way.
Matt, he's done some extraordinary things during his period in power. You know, he caught Bin Laden, not single-handedly, admittedly. He introduced Obamacare. There was the bailout for the auto industry. The strange thing is he doesn't seem to be able to string along these successes into a narrative that appeals to the American public always. Is there something that about him that's a little bit dry and intellectual as well that fails to get over his quite genuine achievements often?
I think that's a really good point. You know, to sum it up in sort of military terms, he's won lots of battles, but he doesn't seem to have won the war, although, of course, any analysis along these lines will be immediately expunged if he gets re-elected, and at this stage it really is still a toss-up. But I think you're right. I think this great storyteller of a candidate who embodied the kind of unique story of America as an African-American with a funny name that rhymed with Osama, who suddenly got all the way to the White House, stopped telling the story of his presidency almost as soon as he moved into the White House. And in fact, Obama himself acknowledged as much in an interview the other day. And it's strange that he should do this because he is a great storyteller. I mean, he wrote two really rather good books, brilliant books for a politician, you might say. But what happened then? And I think what it is that although on one hand he is the guy who likes to spin a yarn and he is this sort of compelling storytelling figure, there is another side to Obama, which is the geeky policy anorak, slightly professorial, a little bit wordy and worthy. And I think he felt that once you moved into the White House, it was beneath you to aim for the theatrical side of the office, that you were commander-in-chief, policymaker-in-chief, but not thespian-in-chief. And I think by doing so, he perhaps missed a trick. To quote Ronald Reagan, who, of course, was famously an actor before he became a politician, he once said, "I don't know how you can do this job without being an actor." And I think Obama has realized belatedly that perhaps he should have been more of an actor. He should have done more on the stage of the presidency to tell the American people a story about themselves at a time when they really need a story. Because, you know, in bread and circuses, there's not a lot of bread around at the moment in this economy, so you have to make up for it with more circuses. And Obama has failed to do that, and in the polls has been paying the price.
It's been striking in this election that it's been very much about the last 4 years more than about the next 4 years. We've been having arguments between Romney and Obama over what's happened rather than what is necessarily going to happen or what they plan to happen. Has that surprised you?
No, I think every presidential election, you know, around an incumbent is really a referendum on his record in office. So to some extent, that was always going to be the case, especially when the last 4 years have been so contentious, especially when only now, belatedly, you're seeing signs of recovery in the American economy. And the interpretation of that recovery is what's going to decide whether Obama stays in the White House or not. But at the same time, you see, for the president, it's a bit tricky because he's got to defend his record. He's got to basically say, what I've been doing for the last 4 years is the right course for this country, but also look ahead to the future. And the way Obama has done it is basically saying, look, we had so much trouble, we inherited such a big mess, that the medicine I've had to apply as the patient was literally dying on the operating table has been very effective, but it's slow to work given the state that we were in. So give me another 4 years and you will see that the medicine will work and America will be back on its feet. And of course, Romney comes in and says, hang on a minute, the medicine should have worked a lot earlier. You know, it's not working. Therefore, you need me, the new doctor-in-chief, to come in and prescribe a completely different kind of medicine. But this is campaign rhetoric. I mean, in so many ways, especially when it comes to foreign policy, which is what the Florida debate was about, the two candidates are pragmatic, center-right politicians who realize that America simply can't afford to be in the occupation business anymore, that you have to scale down, project strength in a different way. And actually, in many ways, they're rather similar, but of course they would never admit that.
Matt, can I ask you actually a professional question? Do you find it sometimes difficult when you're covering this election to kind of explain what Romney's about for an audience that's not in the US? You're trying to tell the story for people here back in the UK via Channel 4. do you sometimes find it a little bit complicated that you understand what Romney the man, why he appeals in the US, but you just can't explain it to people who aren't in America?
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Not just with Romney, but also with Bush, you know, in the previous presidency. There is a real trick, and it's very hard, actually, to try and explain a candidate or president to European sensibilities, which are completely different to mainstream American sensibilities, while at the same time laying out the argument why the other guy, who may seem unacceptable, uncouth, could actually win, and how his victory doesn't necessarily make this a bad country. And I think you're dealing with American elections with a sort of very local heartland politics played out on a global stage. And that's very difficult. Creating that bridge between Iowa or North Carolina and metropolitan London is really quite hard. And when I've been back to the UK, which I have repeatedly over the last year, and I've talked to friends and colleagues, they just can't imagine Mitt Romney ever getting into the White House. They haven't really been paying attention because they just think it's a no-brainer. Obama may have not been as good as he was cracked up to be, but he's still a cool guy. He speaks our language. We kind of get where he's coming from. How could he possibly not get reelected? But there is a very real chance, and at the moment it's a 50-50 toss-up, that he won't be reelected. And if he doesn't get reelected, it's not so much because of racism, latent racism in America, although there is a little bit of that. It's because he hadn't done what it says on the tin. And, you know, people out in America are much more ruthless with changing their politicians than we in the outside world are. And the same thing works the other way around. I mean, they just couldn't understand in America why Britain got rid of Tony Blair or why the party eventually got rid of Tony Blair and put Gordon Brown in. They just don't get that. We couldn't understand in Europe why Mikhail Gorbachev was so unpopular in the Soviet Union, because he spoke to our sensibilities but not to Soviet sensibilities. So I think there's always this sort of perception gap, and it's my job, I guess, to try and bridge it.
When you look at this election in particular and how polarising it's been, I mean, obviously all elections to a certain extent are polarising because, you know, people are asked to choose between one of two sides. But there is this sense that over the last two decades, American politics has become more divided, that there's sort of less independence, that there are less conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans. Do you worry about what the state of politics will be like in a decade's time in the US?
I'm not so sure, actually. I think the reason why we believe that both sides are more divided and the extremes have become more extreme is that we only really hear the extremes most of the time. In the Twitter sphere, in the blogger sphere, on cable television, which is a sort of, you know, daily diet of political opinion and analysis that we journalists and actually quite a lot of the public are subjected to, the opinions are indeed extreme, and they're sort of self-perpetuating in their extremity. But when you come to elections and when you come to opinion polls, most of America still resides somewhere in the conservative middle. You know, there's no doubt that this is a more conservative with a small c country than it is a liberal country. And of course, liberal in this country is often used as an insult rather than a compliment. But I think on the whole, they shy away from extremes, which is why they are quite comfortable with divided government, although they don't want divided government to be dysfunctional, which is what we've had in recent years. They don't like it when they think that their president has become quasi-socialist, and they don't like it if the other guy is going back to kind of a neoconservative philosophy of, you know, bringing liberty to occupation. Most America resides somewhere in the kind of squishy center middle. And that's what you've seen in every election, and especially in this election, that as the day draws closer, they tend to converge somewhere in the center. So Mitt Romney, in his recent debates, is a completely different type of Mitt Romney that we saw during the convention, or indeed, especially during the primaries campaign at the beginning of the year. And this is what everyone was predicting, and indeed it has come about, you might argue, a little bit too late, because had he done so earlier, he might now be even higher in the polls than he is at the moment. And the same with Barack Obama. If you listen to his rhetoric yesterday on foreign policy here in Florida, you know, he was talking like a Republican, not like a peace-loving Democrat. It was all about the projection of strengths. It was all about American exceptionalism. So in many ways, the two candidates, the two parties, and indeed, I think the vast swathe of public opinion converge on those points.
Matt, as we say goodbye, can I just ask you a very final, very quick question? Is it fun covering this election?
It's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun. It's my third election, and they're all a little bit different. The first one I covered was 2004. That was Bush versus Kerry. And the big question there for the world was, how can America be so stupid as to re-elect George W. Bush? And I kept saying, well, listen, mate, you know, this is, don't look at it that way. I mean, George Bush may be a figure of fun and ridicule to metropolitan London, but in heartland America, his values play very, very strong. So watch this space. And he was re-elected. 2008 was historic because it was, first of all, Hillary Clinton versus Barack Obama. Then, of course, Barack Obama's the first African-American victorious candidate. I mean, that was just a piece of history. Everyone sort of remembers what they were doing on the day of his inauguration. And this election has been, was started off as being sort of hideously boring because Mitt Romney is really quite a lackluster candidate, shall we say, on the stump. And, I mean, if you listen to his speeches three times, then, you know, the fourth time would be really excessive. However, of late, he's become a lot better. And because the election is so tight and there's so much at stake, it's a very exciting race to cover. You know, what happens in America doesn't stay in America. This is, it affects everyone around the planet. And yet it will be decided on a sliver of votes in parts of this country that I bet you have never been to or never want to go to.
That was Matt Fry.
And I confused you a little bit there.
You confused me.
Yeah, because he's not really British. Well, not in that kind of pompous kind of nationalist way. I'm not saying he's not British. But when I was looking up his history,
yes,
he's got quite an interesting history. His parents were from Silesia. They moved to Germany. His parents then came to the UK, where his dad was a correspondent for German radio. He ended up working for the BBC in the German division of BBC radio, doing, reporting in German for Germany. And then after a year, he switched over to the main kind of part of the BBC. But it's incredible when you listen. There's obviously, I'm presuming he grew up most of his life here, but there's no kind of hint of him being German these days.
No, there really isn't. Although, I mean, the surname is a slight giveaway.
And actually, when he said, hello, that also, I think, tricked us a little bit.
It did. Actually, now I think about it, it was quite obvious.
No, but I like, do you know, he's one. He's one of those voices I really just love listening to him, what he's got to say. His knowledge of the US as an out, and what for our friends listening in the States, you know, it's great, of course, watching American correspondents talking about their home territory. But every now and then, you just need an outsider to give you their perspective. And I think he's really good at kind of translating what's going on in the US, as he was talking about there, to a kind of an audience that's outside and doesn't often kind of understand the nuances and things that seem a bit odd or, you know, don't quite make sense to a UK audience, for example. He just comes across incredibly well.
Yeah, and it explains perfectly how, you know, America could elect someone like Mitt Romney, how it did elect someone like George W. Bush, which, you know, a lot of people in Europe couldn't really get their heads around. Big fans of Matt Fry. And we also might be hearing some more of him later in the week or the week after as we head up to the elections. He might well be popping into one of our New York shows. We're going to play a little bit of music before we move on to our next item. This is David Byrne and St. Vincent from their wonderful new album. This is Weekend in the Dust. That was David Byrne and St. Vincent with Weekend in the Dust. Do you like that, Andrew?
I do like that very much. Hadn't heard it before.
There we are. Always something new for Andrew Tuck. This is The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Andrew Tuck. We'll be back in a moment with Patrick Kingsley, author of How to Be Danish. Stay tuned.
Tully Kadar, a barista at Mecca Espresso in stunning Sydney, can't decide between the incredible warmth of the people and the outstanding beauty of the scenery when it comes to what makes life in Australia such a daily delight.
We have beautiful weather, a lovely culture, a unique sense of humour. Quality of life is just very high, and I'm very proud of the Aussie culture. I like our matter-of-factness. I feel like we have sort of a good balance between the outgoing, almost ostentatious American style. I'm and the very reserved British sensibility. I feel like we kind of land a healthy balance, and the culture's pretty cool.
There's nothing like Australia.
You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Who wouldn't want to be Danish? Or at least watch their TV, drink their beer, or, you know, just sit on their furniture. From knitwear to fairy tales, Denmark has many more globally renowned exports than you might expect from a small country of just 5.5 million people. And to boot, it's recently been named the happiest nation on earth.
In his new book, How to Be Danish, Patrick Kingsley takes a look at why we're all so obsessed with this Nordic soft power superstar. And Patrick is here with us now in studio. So why are we so obsessed by this soft power superstar, as it were?
Well, I think it's 2.5 reasons, really. The first thing is that, you know, we get all this culture from America, predominantly. Our films and cultural sort of reference points are all from the West. And I think it's sort of exciting that there's this other place that we can find great TV and great food all of a sudden. And so it's the exoticism of the new, really. And the second thing is, I think Denmark just, as well as just being a new place and different to, say, America as a cultural reference point, it has a different culture. There is an ethos of, it's not a simple life there, but I think it's a leaner life. The design is sort of cleaner, simpler. There's a lot of collaboration going on there. You know, it's a place which is sort of built on cooperation. I think one of my favourite moments in Denmark was when I was talking to a load of professors, which sounds a bit boring, but bear with me. Basically, they were linguistics professors, and they were telling me about how the language has changed over the years. And of all the Nordic languages, Danish has changed by far the most. And they said that change has sped up markedly over the last 30 years. And that 30 years happens to coincide with the introduction of kindergarten, free, almost sort of 75% free kindergarten for all Danish children from the age of 6 months. And what that's meant is that all Danish children go to these kindergartens. And so they're only around children the whole time. And so they're only around babbling kids, and they're not around adults who can speak Danish properly. And what that means is that the language, according to this theory, has become more corrupted than it ever has done in the past. And that speaks of this huge welfare state that they have. The state pays for free kindergarten. It pays for free higher education. It means that 70% of Danish mothers can go back to work compared to 50% of British mothers. So it's a different national psyche out there. And I think at this time when we are sort of facing kind of financial ruin, that's not too much exaggeration over here, it's sort of interesting to look at a country, Denmark, that is doing things slightly differently and has a slightly different ethos about it.
I wonder what you thought about the interesting thing about Denmark, obviously a small nation, oddly cohesive, as you say. People don't kind of flaunt wealth, and there isn't a huge kind of amount of poor people in Denmark. So it makes, you know, obviously a very nice cohesive heart. But do you think that makes it complicated for people who are a little bit outside the norm? So I'm not sure how good Denmark is, for example, at absorbing people from other countries. Does it make that, you know, if you don't get that kind of, you know, Dansk way of, you know, living, does it make it a bit complicated if you're an outsider? Or if you're actually a Dane and you want to do something a bit kind of wild and crazy and you don't want to go along with everyone else, is it a little bit regimented, do you think?
I think you're right. I think it is still quite a closed shop. I went and talked to a man who's a relatively liberal imam called Fatih Alif, who runs the only Danish-speaking mosque in Copenhagen. And he was just saying how slightly isolated he feels from the Danish mainstream, even though his mosque is the only one of a few hundred that speaks in Danish. So you'd think that they would want to be sort of embraced by the state. They're not. And he was comparing the Danish politician's attitude to his mosque unfavourably compared to the way that, say, a Swedish politician might deal with an equivalent mosque in that country. And the second thing is that you were saying, does it stifle creativity in Denmark? Well, I mean, I'm sure you heard of this Danish concept, or rather Scandinavian concept of Janteloven, which is the Jantelov, the tall poppy syndrome, the idea that you shouldn't stick your head out, stick your neck out too much, because in case of sort of attracting too much attention, you should just be one of the crowd. And I think that has been the case for a long time. that people sort of feel inhibited. But I think, as your own supplement noted earlier this year, people are starting to throw that off, and that's what makes Denmark quite an exciting country at the moment. You have people like Bjarke Ingels, you have people like Søren Sveistrup, who made The Killing. Bjarke Ingels is this sort of new super architect of the moment. And you have people like René Redzepi and Klaus Meyer, who want to, you know, bring the culinary gods of the world to Denmark. And they're succeeding. And, you know, we're all talking about Denmark and we're all really excited about Denmark. It's because this new crop of Danes is finally prepared to sort of get excited about themselves. So they have faith in themselves. And when I was doing the book time and time again, all the people that I was interviewing were saying, we just have this newfound confidence. But the slight flip side to that is, how Danish are they remaining? You know, someone like Bjarke Ingels, his buildings go completely against what someone like Jan Gehl, who you also profile in your supplement, wanted to do 30 years before. You know, Jan Gehl is all about public space and sort of buildings, modest buildings, which Bjarke wants to create these huge, dynamic, angular shapes, you know, putting blocks of flats on top of car parks. How Danish is that? He may be bringing Denmark to the world, but are we actually seeing Denmark for what it really is? Maybe not. Maybe. Not sure.
How much of a sense did you get from Danes that you were talking to for this book about a sense of sort of surprise that people outside were really interested in what they were doing? When you talk to people about The Killing, and a lot of Danes say, well, I mean, we think it's great, but we don't really understand why you think it's great as well. Do you get this feeling that they're a little bit, not worried, but feel like they don't quite understand why so many people are so interested in what they're doing?
Definitely. I mean, I went to the set of The Killing and I talked to the producer of The Killing and Søren Sveistrup, the creator, and I think he's a bit used to it by now. They're probably almost a bit bored of all this attention being on The Killing. But he was saying, you know, when it first came out, he was on holiday in Thailand, just relaxing by the pool. And suddenly, you know, his phone was going off and he's getting all these emails and he's got all these media requests from people in Britain and so forth. And they all want to, you know, adapt his show for the rest of the world. And he couldn't believe it. Yeah, there's a huge sort of surprise in it. You know, I was surprised that it's just the interest in this book, now that it's been published, in Denmark itself. You know, they all want to know what the rest of the world thinks of it. Because for 150 years, it's been a country that has retreated in itself in order to cope, really. So yes, I think you're right, there is a huge surprise.
Just touching on the Killing, we met the Danish ambassador here in London and we were talking to her about The Killing, and she said, you know, it's been like the most extraordinary calling card for the country. It's strange, here you have a TV programme that's about people being killed, and it touches on all sorts of kind of race issues, and it's dark.
But actually dark all the time as well.
It really is, you know, dark, but somehow, even despite all that, there's a kind of coziness that comes out of it that has appealed to kind of people around the world. And it certainly made people want to go to Copenhagen, despite the thought they might be kind of like slain in some dark alley. What do you think it was about it that kind of went international but also managed to sell Denmark so well?
Well, I think you're right. It was the coziness of the jumper, among other things. You know,
you have a very good jumper on yourself today. I can understand that you were good on the knitwear.
Well, I mean, this jumper was one I bought because I was excited by, you know, the stuff that Sørlund was wearing, and I think there is that kind of homeliness, and also I don't know if it's really necessarily about Denmark per se. It's because it is a very good show. It is a show that goes on for 20 episodes, holds our attention, and it weaves between different aspects of Danish society, the school, the political arena, the family, all these different places, and it weaves between them very skillfully. And it's just a very well put together show in a way that, you know, a lot of police procedurals just aren't really in America. And that's the funny thing about when I talked to Sveistrup, he was saying that he wasn't, in a way, he wasn't trying to do a Danish show. He was trying to do the best show in the world. And he went, and he and his colleagues went to America, and they went and copied, you know, got copied, but went and saw how you make a great multi-episode series. And so he was almost trying to be inspired by sort of America rather than what had come before in Denmark. So I wonder if we're actually, if half of what we're interested in is the fact that you've got Sørlund, this very unusual star of a cop drama, but also it's just a very good version of what we've seen before in American television and English television. At the same time, part of that lack of emphasis on the whole race issue is just because there's a financial crisis going on, and that has consumed the media instead of immigration issues. So I think it's too early to say, but I think you're definitely right. There are the crossroads, and time will tell.
Patrick, maybe finally you could just quickly tell us one surprising thing you discovered about the Danes that you think we should know about.
Well, the most surprising thing was when I went to what was supposed to be the happiest town in the world. And I was very excited. I thought, I'm in pursuit of happiness. This is going to be the place where I find equilibrium. I got off the train. It's late at night. It's taken me 6 hours to get there. It's pitch black. No one's there. And I'm thinking, where is happiness? I'm trying to find happiness. Can't find it. Eventually, I hear this sound from across the town. And I think, well, that could be happiness. It's the sound of some shouting. And I think, is it elixir? People sort of just in the thralls of happiness. And so I follow the sound and I keep on going. And I eventually get to where the sound is coming from. I round the corner. And it's just three kids pissing against a wall, stone drunk.
And who says that's not happiness?
And says, yeah, exactly. Maybe we've got happiness right here on a Friday night down some alley.
Well, Patrick Kingsley, the author of How to Be Danish, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Thank you.
Stephen Newland is a seaplane pilot on Queensland's magnificent coastline and is in no doubt that the colourful, dazzling, awe-inspiring Great Barrier Reef is the finest natural wonder in the world.
I'd have to say, especially around this area here, the water and the scenery is just incredible. The Great Barrier Reef just changes every day. It's never the same.
There's nothing like Australia.
Now, if you haven't guessed by now, you must be a bit stupid, but actually, you're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Andrew Tuck, Steve Bloomfield. I think you're allowed to say that on a Sunday. I think it's fine.
Now, okay, fair enough.
Before we meet our last guest of the programme, it's time for another musical interlude. Here's Solange Knowles with
really?
Losing You.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Is this your choice? I chose David Byrne and St. Vincent.
I know.
You're choosing Beyoncé's little sister.
She's nice. Anyway, take it away, Solange. That was Losing You by Solange Knowles.
Good choice. You're back with Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. This Friday, London's edition of Comic-Con kicked off. It's a three-day bonanza of artists, publishers, tech types and fans that span the industry from manga to gaming. The London MCM Expo attracts on average 50,000 people each year.
And though it's easy to think of the world of superheroes and video games as one of juvenile entertainment, today the medium of illustrated strip-style storytelling is being used more and more for serious biography, political histories, or even as a way to explain Freud.
Yes, really. The momentum of comic novels and non-fiction has been growing for decades and has gained a place in the world of serious literature, from Art Spiegelman's Pulitzer win for Mouse in 1992 to the New York Times adding a graphic novel category to its bestseller list in 2009. For an update on the trajectory of the more serious comic endeavours, we have in studio Simon Hacking and Tom Oldham, co-founders of Berserker, an online magazine dedicated to the comic format. Tom, Simon, welcome to the Monocle Weekly.
Hi there.
Hello.
So, comics, graphic novels, they're not what you don't normally immediately associate them with serious works, do you? And yet, you'd be wrong to not do that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I would say that they have been quite closely associated with serious content for at least the last kind of 20, 30 years since the publication of Mouse by Art Spiegelman, a book about the Holocaust, which came out in 85, I think, and kind of kicked in the beginnings of the graphic novel revolution in comics. And since then, it's actually been a reasonably significant feature of comics. It's just that those kind of comics don't necessarily get talked about as much, so people kind of aren't necessarily aware that they exist.
I sometimes find that some of these discussions are a little bit as if they could be quite frustrating for you, because you go on a show like this and people like us say, oh, so graphic novels, tell us about that, rather than talk about a graphic novel or a comic, in the way that we don't have poets on say, so poetry, what's all that about? So let's move on from that bit. And now let's talk about, I mean, what are the things that you're most excited about at the moment? Who are the new people that are doing really interesting things?
There's a big, really interesting movement in North America at the moment for micro-publishing, of people who are making their own comics, putting them up on the internet for people to read for free on, like, Tumblr's a really big platform for this, and then clubbing together with some friends and getting the money together to print them and distribute them at the internet, and particularly at shows in America. America has a really good scene of conventions and stuff like that. You get a lot of nice, narrow-focus conventions in America, like Brooklyn Comics and Arts Festival is coming up, I think, the 10th of November, which is a small affair in a church in Williamsburg, where mostly kind of small art comics publishers come together and sell their stuff. You won't see any superhero stuff there, basically, and no one will be in costume, ideally. And by being able to go to these events and meet people face-to-face and sell their books, even, I mean, they'll be kind of like photocopied and stapled together, and they'll sell them for a dollar. But this is where the really exciting experimental or even just really high quality work is being produced in comics.
That's just it as well. It's especially in the North American scene at the moment, the scope of the work being produced from sort of like very small sort of photocopied art comics all the way through to sort of, you know, autobiography and stuff like that is really exciting at the moment and sort of pushing different boundaries.
Can I ask you, it's interesting, both of you, that you're referencing, you know, staples and photocopies and paper. Now, you run an online magazine. Where is this as an art form sitting? Is it transferring to iPads and being swiped across screens, or is the real skill of it still actually in a kind of print format?
I would say that comics as a kind of form of storytelling is really the last bastion of print, in terms of print being a really important and a part of the form that cartoonists are really passionate about. So take, for example, Building Stories, which is the new book by Chris Ware that's been very widely well-reviewed, published by Jonathan Cape in the UK, I think. It's a kind of, rather than a book format graphic novel, it's a box with 14 different pieces inside that are each a differently printed kind of part of a story. So one's like a little hardback, like the little Golden Kids books that you used to have. There's like concertina-type things in there. And that's a kind of really great example of how cartoonists have loved to play with print, basically. It seems like digitally, it's either an opportunity for people who can't afford to print their own books to distribute their work, or for the larger mainstream companies like Marvel and DC to distribute the kind of superhero comics that you buy monthly or weekly in a really easy to consume format on the iPad, because the iPad's perfect for that kind of brightly coloured, you know.
And there are examples as well of people sort of really embracing the internet, both in terms of comics culture, as Simon mentioned earlier, through Tumblr and other social networking platforms like that, but also in terms of the comics they're creating being specifically for a sort of online digest, and using everything from the knowledge of how people interact with that by scrolling down and stuff like that, and altering their comics to fit that medium. But certainly the physical print aspect of comics is still very alive and well.
Can I ask a really blunt question? Do any women read them?
Yeah, absolutely. A huge number of women create them. Yeah, again, particularly in the smaller press North American scene and its equivalent over here and like all across Europe. Yeah, I mean,
who's a good example then of a woman who's in this field actually making graphic novels or comic books? Who would you rate as somebody that's interesting?
I would say at the moment people that are exciting me are people like Angie Wang.
I mean, Alison Bechdel, who published her memoir Fun Home, I think about 4 or 5 years ago, just released the sequel earlier this year, called Are You My Mother, which sold massively well. And she's a really well-respected cartoonist in the business who happens to be female, basically. Yeah, she's definitely an example of how there just isn't really necessarily a difference between women creating comics and men creating comics.
we've often covered here on Monocle, on radio and in print, the kind of the world of the manga in Japan. And I know that it's a kind of slightly different discipline. But what's interesting, I think, when we've written about them is, you know, that we have a, you know, kind of one, again, one version of that tends to kind of come to the West. It's kind of, you know, gory and death and, you know, killing people. But we've done, you know, written about mangas that tell you about the, you know, the history of cheese, or, you know, how to be a wine connoisseur. And there's a real kind of, you know, serious storytelling and information kind of element there. Do you think that some of that kind of tradition was originally behind the crossover to the same thing in the kind of Western graphic novel? Is there a relationship between the two, or are they completely separate genres?
I think that there's been a lot of cross-pollinization over the years between manga and Western comics, but they both very much have their own separate lineages and where they derive from.
I would say as well, the reason, if manga has had an influence, it's simply that comics are, because the other kind of illusory preconception is that manga is something different to comics. Manga is just the Japanese word for comics. Japan has had an industry and a kind of comic scene that has been a lot larger than that of the rest of the world for a lot longer. And so I would say it's simply the case that Japan has had longer to get such a wide breadth of content to their comics, whereas because the North American and kind of European scenes have only developed to their current state in the last kind of few decades, that's why you're getting that stuff come through now. It's just a question of the scene expanding to the point where enough people read comics that enough people create comics with all kinds of content.
You've mentioned that the North American scene that's obviously thriving at the moment, and obviously then we just talked about Japan. Is there anywhere else in the world that you're particularly excited about what's being produced at the moment?
I'm excited about this country, especially in the last sort of 5 years or so. We've seen sort of an explosion of publishers, whether it's people like Nobrow or Blank Slate, Self-Made Hero, and indeed a real expansion of the small press scene and a step up in terms of the quality of the product. So you have publications like Solipsistic Pop and other anthologies that are really presenting interesting work.
And do your roots in this, you know, did you start off as kids like in comics, or is it something you came through from a more literary side, or, you know, from a design side? How did you both get into this world?
I never really read comics as a kid, to be honest. It was when I was kind of a teenager and the superhero movie started coming out. I think it was after the X-Men movie came out, which was one of the first ones. I thought, oh yeah, I'll have a look at this, because I remember liking the cartoon when I was a kid and stuff like that. And superheroes were kind of the gateway drug to finding out about the more interesting literary kind of artistic side of the medium. Then at university, I decided that I was interested enough in it that I wanted to kind of study it academically. So I did a master's degree and wrote about comics in that. And then it was during that I met Tom, and we kind of had similar ideas about comics and came together to run the magazine.
Yeah. Tom, did you come to us as late, or do you have stacks of comics underneath your bed at home?
Yeah. I obviously read superhero and humour comics as a kid, and British anthologies, sci-fi anthologies like 2000 AD and stuff. And then through that, sort of learnt about... It's almost like growing up and all you read is novels about cowboys or something, and then someone says, oh, do you know about like Shakespeare and stuff like that? And when I got to about 17, 18, I started to realise there was a wider world of comics. Then I met Simon, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Now, Tom, let's talk about Comic-Con, which you're not going to be at all this weekend, because you think it's rubbish. Yeah?
this is the MCM Expo, yeah?
Yes.
You know, to be fair to the MCM Expo, they are what they are, and what they are is it's a science fiction convention. Effectively, comics are a part of it, anime, television, computer games. It's a certain part of the culture that whilst I dabble in, it's of no real interest to me.
There are a number of those kind of larger conventions. MCM does a couple a year. The London Super Comic Con is a similar one. But then there's loads of really interesting smaller ones. We just had the Birmingham Zine Fair a few weeks ago, I think. And in July, Nobrow, that Tom mentioned earlier on, who are a really great comics publisher, put on LCAF, the East London Comics and Arts Festival, at Village Underground in Shoreditch, that was massively successful. A free event that had cartoonists selling their work as well as illustrators and that kind of stuff, and was a real, as far as I can see, the first time that side of comics has been properly covered by a festival in the UK.
And then coming up we have Thought Bubble, which is an excellent convention in Leeds. Alison Bechdel, who Simon mentioned earlier, is a guest this year, and that's covering all sorts of aspects of comics and is slightly more cerebral and intelligent engagement.
Thought Bubble is definitely the good big convention to go to. Absolutely, if you go to one, Thought Bubble's the really good large one to go to.
Do you ever get frustrated though that is essentially sort of the image that people have of the world of comics is based on things like Comic-Con?
That's absolutely the point of the blog, is to kind of try and make it clear to people that there is much more to comics than that. I think people know that nowadays, really. I mean, that's not the kind of stuff... The superhero side is not the side that gets promoted in the bookstores and on Amazon and stuff like that. I think people know there's more out there, but I just don't think they're sufficiently explained, if you know what I mean. So they don't see the... You don't get enough reviews of the really interesting stuff in the mainstream media, in newspapers, on TV and radio. And so people don't hear about the really exciting work that I think people would be really keen on if they did know about it.
Simon Hacking and Tom Oldham from Berserker Magazine, thank you both very much. And don't forget, you can read our reports on No Brow Magazine in issue 48 of Monocle and on Self-Made Hero in issue 43. You're listening to Monocle Weekly. So we've been to America, we've sort of been to Denmark, and we've been here.
Yeah, probably been to other planets, God knows where, with comics. Been around the world.
And I.
It's a shame that Monocle's not a comic. There'd been fewer words in it to write.
Well,
I might suggest that to Tyler.
You say that, but you know, we did once have a comic.
Well,
We had a manga.
We loved a couple of years. Yeah, we loved the manga.
We did, it was great. But there were quite a few words in that.
Nils Watanabe.
Yes.
He got up to all sorts of things he did.
And there was a lot of translating to do as well.
Yes, there was a lot of translating to do. Poor Yoshi, who was in charge of the project of getting it made in Tokyo and then translated back here. It was complicated.
It was, but yeah. it was a really good addition. We should think about bringing that back.
I tell you, the whole bloody issue. That's what I say.
Okay, well, we'll think about that. That's it. That's your lot.
You're off to America?
I am, yes. What about you? What are you doing?
I've actually got a couple of days off. How about
really?
That? Yeah. I don't know what I'm going to do with them. I've never had them before in 5 years.
I think you have.
No, I have. I've got a couple of days off, which I'm actually not going to do very much with. I'm going to enjoy myself.
Okay, you do that. I'll jet off to New York. That's all for this 173rd edition of The Monocle Weekly. The show was produced by David Michon. The studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week. But for now, from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And me, Andrew Tuck, it's goodbye.